the sea entering into the life of most men, and the men knowing something or everything about the sea, in the way of amusement, of travel, or of bread-winning. We were sitting round a mahogany table that reflected the bottle, the claret glasses, and our faces as we leaned on our elbows. There was a director of companies, an accountant, a lawyer, Marlowe, and myself. The director had been a Conway boy. The accountant had served 4 years at sea. The lawyer, a fine crusted Tory, high churchman, the best of old fellows, the soul of honour, had been chief officer in the P&O service in the good old days when mail boats were square rigged at least on two masts, and used to come down the China Sea before a fair monsoon with stunsails set alow and aloft. We all began life in the merchant service. Between the five of us there was the strong bond of the sea, and also the fellowship of the craft, which no amount of enthusiasm for yachting, cruising, and so on can give, since one is only the amusement of life, and the other is life itself. Marlowe, at least I think that's how he spelt his name, told the story, or rather the chronicle, of a voyage. "Yes, I've seen a little of the Eastern Seas, but what I remember best is my first voyage there. You fellows know there are those voyages that seem ordered for the illustration of life, that might stand for a symbol of existence. You fight, work, sweat, nearly kill yourself, sometimes do kill yourself, trying to accomplish something. And you can't. Not from any fault of yours. You simply can do nothing, neither great nor little, not a thing in the world, not even marry an old maid or get a wretched 600-ton cargo of coal to its port of destination. It was altogether a memorable affair. It was my first voyage to the East, and my first voyage as second mate. It was also my skipper's first command. You'll admit it was time. He was 60 if a day. A little man, with a broad, not very straight back, with bowed shoulders and one leg more bandy than the other. He had that queer, twisted-about appearance you see so often in men who work in the fields. He had a nutcracker face, chin and nose trying to come together over a sunken mouth, and it was framed in iron-grey, fluffy hair that looked like a chin-strap of cotton wool sprinkled with coal-dust. And he had blue eyes in that old face of his, which were amazingly like a boy's, with that candid expression some quite common men preserve to the end of their days by a rare internal gift of simplicity of heart and rectitude of soul. What induced him to accept me was a wonder. I'd come out of a crack Australian clipper, where I'd been third officer, and he seemed to have a prejudice against crack clippers as aristocratic and high-toned. He said to me, "You know, in this ship you'll have to work." I said I had to work in every ship I'd ever been in. "Ah, but this is different. A new gentleman out of them big ships. But there, I dare say you'll do. Join tomorrow." I joined tomorrow. It was 22 years ago, and I was just 20. How time passes. It was one of the happiest days of my life. Fancy, second mate for the first time, a really responsible officer. I wouldn't have thrown up my new billet for a fortune. The mate looked me over carefully. He was also an old chap, but of another stamp. He had a Roman nose, a snow-white long beard, and his name was Mahon, but he insisted that it should be pronounced Man. He was well connected, but there was something wrong with his luck, and he never got on. As to the captain, he'd been for years in coasters, then in the Mediterranean, and last in the West Indian trade. He'd never been round the Capes. He could just write a kind of sketchy hand, and didn't care for writing at all. Both were thorough good seamen, of course, and between those two old chaps I felt like a small boy between two grandfathers. The ship also was old. Her name was the Judea. Queer name, isn't it? She belonged to a man, Wilmer, Wilcox, some name like that. But he's been bankrupt and dead these 20 years or more, and his name doesn't matter. She'd been laid up in Shadwell Basin for ever so long. You may imagine her state. She was all rust, dust, grime, soot aloft, soot on deck. To me it was like coming out of a palace into a ruined cottage. She was about 400 tons, had a primitive windlass, wooden latches to the doors, not a bit of brass about her, and a big square stern. There was on it, below her name, in big letters, a lot of scroll work, with a gilt off, and some kind of a coat of arms, with the motto, "Do or Die," underneath. I remember it took my fancy immensely. There was a touch of...